All right, this is a little different than what we've been doing, only this one is so simple and so obvious that I don't know if I'm wasting your time to talk about it. We're talking in this series this week about different kinds of spiritual cycles, saying that cycles are in everything. We spent the last three nights talking about what the Rosicrucian philosophy calls the life cycle and what other philosophies call the wheel of rebirth. Now that's a cycle that has been studied very extensively for thousands of years. People have looked at it and there are many, many treatises on that cycle. What we're going to look at tonight is something a little bit more simpler, with regard to the life cycle, some philosophies study it to learn how to escape it. The Rosicrucian philosophy is just a little bit more humble, I guess you would say. It seeks to learn how to work with the reality and to be more efficient in it, and to fulfill its purpose. It does talk about leaving that spiral, but only when its purpose has been fulfilled and complete. Now, we have only looked at some of the high points of it, and we've only looked at it in terms of things that you can apply in your own life. If you want a descriptive view of it, you can get a very good descriptive view of it from the Rosicrucian Cosmo Conception. It goes through the whole cycle and does it in a very nice way. Now, as useful as our outlook on that cycle has been, or could have been, or will have been, it has been not satisfying in one way. Because in looking at that cycle, it hasn't been a matter of hands-on, first-hand experience. We had to rely on the observations of others. We may even have some remembrances of some stages of the cycle in the past, but even that is pretty remote. What we want is we want the experience of it, and we want it right now. We are children of fire. We are mystic masons, and we want that firsthand experience, and we want to take more and more of our destiny and our lives in our own hands. We want to be in control, or at least we say we do, because sometimes what we say and what we actually do aren't very close to each other. Because the fact of the matter is that we have a lot of first-hand experience of cycles. And with that first-hand experience, we are not taking advantage of it. We are not doing what we could do to be in control of our lives. So let's assume that we do want to have a more proactive stance about our lives and taking control of them. And let's look at a cycle that is much more immediate and much more present to our consciousness as we experience it every day. Now, whether we realize it or not, we are within or within us are many, many, many cycles. And they aren't all cycles of the environment. Some are, like the cycles of the seasons, or the cycle we've been talking about in the afternoon, the lunation cycle of the sun and moon. And there are all kinds of astrological cycles. Those are environmental. They're outside. There are a lot of cycles right within ourselves, like in our physical bodies. For example, there's the Krebs cycle, which is active on the cellular level. It's the basic metabolic cycle. It's sometimes called the citric acid cycle. And that takes place in each cell sometimes thousands of times per minute. So whether we know it or not, even if we're just vegging out, even if we're just laying there and metabolizing, we are very, very active. And at some level, we are the unconscious part of ourself is very busy. When we say that somebody is just metabolizing, we try to say that as an insult. That is not an insult to the spirit, because the spirit is at work. And over many repetitions, that experience is sinking into the spirit. We're working hard. So the next time somebody catches us snoozing, we can just outright say, I'm working hard. it is that. That is true. Now, farmers are observant of environmental cycles, especially the cycle of the seasons. When are the fields going to be dry enough so that you can get out there and plant and have the longest possible growing season? Sometimes they're keenly aware of weather patterns, because if you're growing corn for seed, you want to get it as dry as possible, but you don't want it to be frosted. So just a matter of 1 degree of temperature on a given night might make a big difference in terms of finances. Because if it looks like it's going to freeze and you have to harvest early, that means you're going to have to dry it artificially, and that's going to cost a lot of money. And so there are times when people are very much aware of what's going on in some of the cycles. Now, there's one cycle that the Rosicrucian philosophy, or at least in its statement, pays a lot of attention to. There are several pages that are dedicated to it in the Cosmo Conception, and that's the cycle that we're going to talk about this evening. It's an important cycle because it involves our waking consciousness and our activities of consciousness. So it is one of those things that if we pay attention to it, we can get more out of it. Ironically, that's just the thing we don't do. Most of the time, we're unconscious of it, and we put very little into it unless we train ourselves to do that. It's so important that two of the Rosicrucian exercises, the morning and evening exercises, are based on it in one form or another. Now, there is no name for this cycle, but we will call it the cycle of introversion and extroversion. Let's look at that cycle in a very simple way. A way that we all have experienced this cycle, even though we're continuously experiencing it, and that we are familiar with. Now, in St. John's Gospel, the biblical Christ describes himself in 9 different ways. Actually 10, but one is a repeat. It is all of the I ams of what Christ says Christ is. Now, since the Rosicrucian philosophy does a lot with St. John's Gospel, that's a pretty good place to begin. In the St. John's Gospel, the biblical Christ says, I am the way. Just the way Lao Tzu, in very similar terms, talked about the way that he called the Tao. In our times, the way is the street, or it is the highway. Because of this, if we observe our behavior when we're driving, it's a very excellent way to get a check on the quality of our spiritual lives, our progress toward being like Christ. It's more than just a matter of noting whether we are alert and attentive, which is a big part of it. It's very, very important. It's something that's vitally important. It is an indicator of our outlook or our attitude toward others, toward life itself. Because even criminals can be alert and attentive, and sometimes they're more alert and attentive than other people. It's vital to them in another way. When we are encapsulated in that little metal box with wheels on it, our consciousness seems to change. The change seems to be a magnification of the deeper we are encapsulated in our dense physical bodies. Because the more we are incarnated, the more we are focused in materiality, the more the individualism of our discrete personality separates us. I've got a lot of discrete personality, it seems. And I have to wear this kind of shirt, which is a big embarrassment. Maybe that's why all of this is taking place. It seems like our whole consciousness changes. There, you put a person behind the wheel and you see that what their egoism is like magnified very much. They don't scream and shout too much, but you know what I'm talking about. It's that kind of thing. In that discrete personal existence, we have an attitude. Here in the United States, that attitude seems to be, your business ends where my nose begins. As if to say, you know, get off the highway. You're a bother to me. So the way of Christ, when he says, I am the way, is the way of all. Because in Christ we are all one. We share a common universal selfness. In reality, we are all vortices within the ocean that is the selfness of Christ. It's interesting to see if we really have a Christian orientation or if we have egoism when we drive. It can be determined very quickly by asking ourselves several questions. I almost sometimes think I would like to tape them right on the steering wheel, these questions. First one, am I driving in such a way that I'm trying to see that everyone can get to their destination as surely, as safely, and as smoothly as possible? Most of the time, that's not the case. I'd say with almost all the time. With myself, what I find is that I'm self-important and I'm egocentric. I'm concerned about getting to where I'm going. And the actions of the other drivers benefit that, or they are an impediment to that. That's a very egocentric viewpoint. Being egocentric, it often becomes competitive. It even becomes combative. And it's not common, you know, my father was a very good man. And when I was a teenager, I noted he had that attitude. Not that I was any great observer of human nature, but I just happened to notice it, you know. When you're becoming independent, you notice how bad your parents are. And it takes you quite a few years before you realize how good they are. But my observation of my natural father in driving is that everybody that drove faster was to him a maniac. And everybody that drove slower than him was a malleputz. And everybody that drove the same speed just got in the way. So you couldn't drive faster, you couldn't drive, so you couldn't, you know, if he was thinking of himself. And he's not a man that really thought of himself any more than other people, but that's what happens to us when we have that magnified view of ourselves in the way. If we think about this, this kind of outlook about driving is even more rigorous than defensive driving. Because in defensive driving, you're still thinking about yourself. You have yourself in mind. In this, you're driving in such a way that you think about the all, or you think about others. If we live in Christ, we don't demean ourselves, and we don't diminish our self-importance. We see the truth of the self within, but we see it within the context of the all. We see it with the Christ eye view, the spirit of that other person being just as important within the one as we are. We can't put ourselves down if we're in Christ any more than we can't, we can't cringe on the highway and not be decisive and do anything on our own, because that's just as dangerous and that's just as inconsiderate as having to have one's own way and do things for your own sake. Now suppose you're driving down a highway, a two-lane highway, and suppose you come up to someone who's driving considerably slower. And suppose coming the other direction at a far distance is another automobile. Now you observe this situation, you observe the highway and its condition, and you observe the relative speed of all the autos. And on the basis of this observation, you try to determine whether it is safe and legal for you to pass the slower vehicle. Now this is something all of us have done, and we've all done it many, many times, and we've observed ourselves doing it many, many times. But it is also the perfect example of the cycle that we're talking about, that we've gone through so many times, and that we go through it so fast that it's almost continuous. You know that physiologists, materialistic physiologists, believe life is, or what they believe consciousness is. They find that there are loops of one brain cell or a nervous cell triggering another and another, and then they produce these loops, and they're going on almost continuously, and they think that is what consciousness is, and that when the loops stop, that you become unconscious, and that is what would be called a kind of brain death. We're talking about a continuous cycle, a continuous activity, but we're not saying that it's completely material in its origin. We're saying that it is something that in our bodies that we use to grow and experience life. Now, like all cycles, we could begin almost anywhere in our analysis of it. We will begin with the introversive state. In doing that, we are doing exactly what we did with the life cycle. That is, we are beginning with an immediate outward experience and working backward from them. The introversive stage of the cycle begins with perception. One of the first things which needs to be spoken of is reality versus our conception of reality. That's one of the big things that goes on. People who are sensitives sense that there is more to reality than we normally perceive or than we more normally conceive. That is, if we're materialistic. Because sensitives are very often spiritual enthusiasts, they get carried away, and sometimes they're not in control of their imagination, and their conceptions aren't always lined up with reality. All of us are sensitives, or we wouldn't be sitting in a room like this. And all of us tend to have our imaginations get away from us. And when that happens, we are divorced from reality, which is almost a description of insanity. So perception, when we say of a person who has lost it, it says, have you taken leave of your senses? Meaning for some people, the senses are the all, but the senses are extremely important. Some people who are sensitive think that the inner worlds are the real worlds, and that this doesn't matter, that this is just a barren place that we have to go through as some kind of hell or something like that, rather than this being a proving ground, rather than this being a place where we can live our life out without the influence too much of the gods and the other spiritual beings. So you can look at it as an exile or a cosmic quarantine or something like that, or you can look at it as our human private proving ground. In this world, we have, as humans, have a very special privilege. It's something I've mentioned before, and I can't mention it too often. We are the eyes and ears of God. In the chemical region of the physical world, when we are in our dense physical bodies, we are the only beings in this plane of existence that are self-conscious of what's going on. We are the only beings that can see the glories of the external, I guess you'd say the outer rim of the creation. And we are the only ones that can report that all-important external to the gods and to the universal spirit. Now, some of the animals have senses, but they're not self-conscious. And for the most part, they're concerned primarily with somatic existence. And for that reason, you know, they're bound up with the senses only as far as keeping themselves alive. They can't see all of the beauty. So for us, as self-conscious beings, it is extremely important for us to be perceptive, because that's one of our great, great services. The biblical Christ stated with great wisdom, ye have eyes, but see not. And I think that describes all of us. It describes me, and I'm assuming you're similar to me. I can't be that weird and different. If we aren't generally excelling in perception in this realm, if we aren't doing our duty or fulfilling our privilege here, how can we possibly hope to be have the gift of higher perception? We could be just as inattentive, and we could be just as self-indulgent with higher perception as we are with the senses that we have already. Now, to remedy this situation, the Rosicrucian philosophy has exercises that are dedicated to this very activity. There's a whole series of exercises that's described over several pages in the Cosmoconception. The basic spiritual exercises in the Rosicrucian philosophy are concentrative. In fact, the Rosicrucian philosophy teaches that to practice meditation before one has developed sufficiently in concentration is an unhealthy thing to do. And it distorts the order in the inner consciousness of the individual. The Rosicrucian philosophy teaches that those exercises are self-teaching, such that if you are concentrated and it is a voluntary faculty, your concentration penetrates into the realm that is called meditation, and meditation is the next step that each exercise leads to the exercise that follows after it. It's not like being in first grade and skipping a couple of grades and going to fourth grade. You can't do that. in our consciousness, things unfold according to the whole pattern of the evolutionary creation, and it's very healthy to follow something like that. But at any rate, in this series of exercises, one is taught to concentrate on seeing or hearing or touching or tasting or smelling or something like that, and to see what is really there. And boy, have I learned about that from not being able to do that right. For 2 months now, my vision has not been good since having 2 surgeries on my eye. And I can't see things clearly. And my consciousness has not been so screwed up as it has been in the last 2 months for many, many years. You keep waiting for it to clear up. Because what your consciousness is in a very large part dependent on how clearly you see reality. This material world has all kinds of limitations in it, and all our senses have all kinds of limitations and illusions in them, but they're the ground floor of our developing our consciousness. And if we don't perceive things clearly, or if we're haphazard about it, we're building on a faulty foundation. We can't possibly ever hope to have a healthy consciousness unless we use what we have. The step after concentration is called discrimination. Before we come to that, let's look at something else. If one has an exercise of looking at things very, very clearly, you could ask yourself a question: how is this any different than the work of a painter or the work of an observational scientist? And the answer to that is, it isn't any different, because it's the same reality. Our quest for soul growth and the special exercises we do to attain that end shouldn't put us apart from other people. It should unite us with other people, and we should all be participating together in doing the best we can in this same reality. If there is a difference between a mystical aspirant and an ordinary human being, it is that we try to do things more self-consciously, and we try to do them realizing that there is a higher purpose in mind, or that there is a higher being that has its ends in mind. It's communion. Christ says, this do in remembrance of me. And boy, I wish I could really live my life, my every activity in that way, so that I could be in remembrance of that instead of in remembrance of my own ends all the time. When we concentrate our attention in perception, we do so knowing that there's something beyond what the eye sees, even though we appreciate the great grandeur, the great magnificent beauty of everything that we see. We know there's something beyond. Now, each of our bodies has a character of its own. But even when we know that, we don't always work with it. In our scheme of things, that is, in the chemical region of the physical plane, we're the farthest from the creative spirit. And we're the closest to the dead, impassive matter that is barely out of cosmic root substance. In its limits, this matter is impassive. It's inert, and it has all kinds of limitations that are impersonal and objective. Materialists believe that this is all there is, in that they try to portray the world as it is in some kind of a stark naturalism. They try to portray it as a cold, hard, Darwinian world. They see natural selection as something that is the way things go. It's merciless. The fit survive. Sometimes they do that so much they don't even pay attention to the fact that in the evolutionary process, much more is created by cooperation than by survival. Cooperation like the cooperation of the birds and the bees. All of the plants that use birds and bees for pollination have evolved much more and have diversified much more than the plants that don't use birds and bees. They've endured, but they haven't evolved. So there is a lot of cooperation. Now, in this cold, stark world, the view of the Darwinians is to some extent true. But it isn't, it seems cold and merciless, but the group spirits of the animals of prey and of predator, they are using each other to help the evolution of each species advances in that common battle. Each species improves all of its faculties because it is of vital importance. The group spirits know that it's eternal, and it really is a life and death matter. We would probably be better off if we did everything that we did with a life and death intensity. So there is something very cold and objective about this world and about our bodies. But what better ground could we have to learn simple objectivity? The simplest objectivity of all. And that's what it is all about when we're talking about observation. We want to be objective. We want to get the facts as they are. So we can't look at the car that's in front of us and feel that it's going slower because we're itching to pass it. We have to look at the car that's in front of it to know exactly how fast it's going, because otherwise we're endangering everybody. We must see it as it is, or we're going to have a lot of accidents. Some people, in fact, do miss-see things because they desire to pass, and they have impaired judgment, or they have impaired ability to make judgment because of their psychology. In the set of exercises from the Rosicrucian philosophy that we've been talking about, the next stage is called discrimination, which is a tough word these days because so many words have become loaded. You know, and they become loaded, and they have all, some of them have multiple connotations, especially with things that we're not comfortable with. I think gay is a lovely word. I'm willing to use gay as a word that means happiness, and I'm willing to use gay as a word that means somebody who's homosexual. I like the idea of a faggot being a glowing branch of wood in a fire. I don't want to throw that word away, and I don't want to let it be stolen by some callous kind of hatred. But at any rate, discrimination has taken on a meaning that, oh, this person discriminates against other people. Well, the word discrimination means being able to tell the difference between things. And that is what the next step is. We're trying to see what is the difference, what does it mean? In this case, we're trying to discriminate between the speed of the three different vehicles and the what that difference of speed between those three vehicles means. Now, such a definition would take into account the energy and all of those kinds of things that is being used. It would take into account the laws of Newton and of Galileo. Now, the Rosicrucian cosmic conception gives a very elaborate example of a kind of discrimination that leads to meditation. It takes something like a simple chair. We don't have a simple one here. Ours are all metallic. And it traces it all the way back to the tree and the life of the tree out of the wood of which that chair was made out of. It's quite a thing. It's quite an advanced exercise. Now, this whole stage of the cycle that we're looking at is often called backwards. That is, it follows the objective perception of the reality to how it came to be that way. It also could go forward, and you can see where it's going. In the case of our automobiles, there are three different philosophies and the differential between the three. However, following backward and observing something is not necessarily limited to developments in time, because spiritual vision often follows things backwards. It follows a chain of vertical antecedent causes, as we saw when we looked at the life cycle. That's just a fancy philosophical way of saying following something back to the higher cause that precipitated it in this lower condition that we experience. Again, our automobile example makes things clearer. Because if we focus our attention more deeply on all three autos, we might perceive more than differential velocities. You can tune in to the motivation or the desire natures of any of the three drivers. We've all done that. We do it all the time, but we don't know that we're doing it. You know, like if we focus on our attention on the car immediately in front of us, we may sense that the driver is going to get competitive if we try to pass him. We've had that happen. You go to pass somebody who's going slow, and suddenly they start speeding up when you're going to pass them. Or sometimes the person may panic if we try to pass. The oncoming driver might be of a saturnine disposition and decide to slow down in caution. You don't have to be a full-blown clairvoyant to do this. We do it all the time, and unfortunately, we don't do it self-consciously. If we did, our progress might be faster. We might actually improve as human beings at a quicker rate than we're doing now. If we are knowledgeable, and if we are self-conscious in doing whatever we are doing, it is spiritual exercise. And since spiritual things are intensive more than they are extensive, there is no limit to how much we can put into any activity. There is no limit to how much spirit we can put into very simple material action, physical actions. All life is a spiritual exercise. And we're more or less effective depending on how much we put into it, how much we give ourselves to it. I said, I am the life. Therefore, when we are giving ourselves to life, we're giving ourselves to Christ. That's maybe not the standard orthodox interpretation that we hear in churches or something like that, but it certainly is a completely valid interpretation of that statement. When we follow this antecedent causation, we're following the same path that we followed in the life cycle. We're following the postmortem path rather than the antenatal path. The difference is that we're following back in a dynamic, in an ongoing living system, not an unwinding that we have no control over. That is a runaway unwinding. So following the next step in this antecedent chain of causation, is to find the thought that is behind the desire, behind the originally observed objects that we've started looking at. Now, in this very simple example that we're using when we're driving down the highway, that probably doesn't mean that we psychoanalyze the mentality of each of the drivers. We could do that, but it would be an awfully inefficient kind of driving. It would lead us away from our goal. This is not said to be facetious or pedantic. It is to point out something that is very, very important about this stage of activity in the cycle that we're talking about. It is an important fact that the vertical antecedent investigation is extremely accurate and extremely efficient. One is not proceeding downward and forward in cosmological activity. When one is going in the other direction, there are many possible things that could happen to a given cause. But when we're proceeding upward as we are now and backwards from facts, we are actualizing things in an irrevocable way. There's only one cause that leads to this consequence. So it's a special kind of consciousness that we have when we're looking back like this. Even if there were multiple causes that led to the effect that we have just observed, we can see what part each of them had in that effect. The backwards path, the postmortem path, the introversive path, is a path of fact. It is a fact, and the more we stick to the fact, no matter on what level we are looking at that fact, the better we are working, the better we can perform our lives. The facts are the facts. And if we view them correctly, they always lead to the correct antecedent causes. It's more likely, in doing this activity that the thought in this situation is a thought about calculating relative speeds and distances from the observations we've just made. It's more likely the thought is behind the desires and that is behind the actions is seeing how fast everybody's going. And again, that is not pondering. It's not like psychoanalysis. It's not the philosophy of driving. And it's not even using Newton's and Galileo's laws. But at any rate, we think about what's happening. And at this point in the cycle, we reach a stage when all the information from the perception has been presented to the spirit. And then something very important happens. Something very, very important happens. When this information is presented to the spirit by the personality, it's not like the personality meeting the true self in third heaven. It's not like that. It could be, but there would be a lot of accidents if it were. What happens is that two things come together and a third thing is formed. One of the things that meets is what we've been talking about, the perception and everything involved in the perception. There is a perception, even though there aren't eyes in the desire body, there is a perception in the desire world, and that's what clairvoyance is. We can also read other people's minds, even though the concrete mind doesn't have eyes or even sensitized areas yet for perceiving. Or else we couldn't read those minds. But at any rate, we get all the facts, and as much as we can understand of them, and we present them to the Spirit. The second thing that happens is that within the spiritual being, the Spirit meets it with intuition. Intuition that interprets the meaning or that brings knowledge to the situation. And the more awake the Spirit is, the more it has experienced from evolution, the better or the more the intuition that it brings to the situation. Because even the Spirit is improving. The Spirit is perfect, but when it says the Spirit is perfect, that talks about the quality or the manner in which the Spirit does things. It doesn't mean that the Spirit is done with doing everything and that there isn't going to be improvement within that perfect way that the Spirit does things. The third thing that comes out of these two things, the information and intuition, judgment. The human is capable of good, sound judgment. All of us are capable of good, sound judgment. If we want to grow spiritually, we have to improve in all three factors. We have to get clear information to understand what we are experiencing, and we have to listen for the intuition, and we have to learn how to interpret it. And from that, we have to form good, sound judgments. Many things are happening continuously in our inner nature. And if we don't know ourselves and we don't know what's going on within ourselves, we're going to err. For example, in youth, when we really don't know ourselves inwardly, when we're little bitty children, we sometimes know ourselves. But when in our youth, we don't. And we substitute desire urges and impulses for intuitions. And we have all kinds of bad judgments. I don't want to be on the road where there's a bunch of teenies driving. You know, they haven't made that discrimination yet. Sometimes we're not careful about our observation, and we assume apparent facts. And if we do that, we're not exercising good, sound judgment. I remember one time I was in Southern California, and I was running across the Pacific Highway. And you know those things that they have in parking lots to separate different parking, you know, those they're bars of concrete that go along like that. And they're shaped almost like the roof of a barn. I'm running across the Pacific Highway, and I see that there's a divider like that. And it's yellow, and then there's a space, and then it's yellow, and then there's a space. There wasn't a space. It's just that it was painted yellow in some places and it wasn't painted yellow in other places. And I ran right smack into that. I went down on my face. I skinned my knees. I skinned my hands. And I assumed that this was like every other case that I had seen before. This is just like in the parking lot. They're saving on materials here. They're not putting it all. And you know, you can't assume. You have to make good, sound judgment. Now, when the judgment is formed, the second stage of the cycle begins. Obviously, the first part of the second stage is thinking, to carry out the intuitive impulse from what we've learned from the judgment. This thinking is in the same stage of the cycle as building the archetype before coming back to rebirth. And that brings out something pretty important. It obviously means that there are different grades and kinds of thinking. Some thoughts take decades to ponder on. like the concept that is the Rosicrucian philosophy was pondered on by adepts to find the most efficient, clear, best way to present it to the world and the needs of the world. And the archetype of the Rosicrucian Fellowship is something that was thought about for a long, long time. But that's a more creative kind of thought. It's not like a thought of taking your foot off the gas pedal. It's something, you know, the taking your foot off the gas pedal doesn't require a whole lot of judgment. In fact, it happens so quickly that sometimes the self doesn't even need to be involved in it. There is something like an autopilot. Earl was talking about it in his talk when he said that there is a reflective surface in the concrete mind, that there can be instantaneous actions without having to ponder a meaning of anything at all. Now, in the thought process, in the extroversive process, when one is breathing out this judgment or this new impulse to action or inaction, some thoughts are weak. And they're too weak to be projected against the desire body. We have a lot of thoughts that are so feeble that they never amount to anything. You can sit there and think about things and something comes along, an ant walks across your hand and you're distracted from it, and that thought never goes anywhere. The Rosicrucian philosophy also teaches that some thoughts don't take the normal route to activation. There is a special resonance between the concrete mind and the reflecting ether of the vital body. The reflecting ether where the so-called subconscious mind is formed, and one can bypass desire and thoughts can strike immediately and act that way. In some cases, it's even more radical than that. In some cases, intuitions bypass the mind, bypass the desire body, and strike directly on the vital body. And we can act instantaneously and we can act very purely because it comes straight from the spirit if we learn to follow that kind of intuition. This is why we have to take time and cultivate an inner life. We don't want to be like teenagers that are zip gunners and jump off without knowing what is moving them from within, whether it's desire or whether it's a true intuition or whether it is a thought that has bypassed desire. Sometimes we don't even know if it's our own thought. If somebody projects the thought against our etheric body, if the person, you know, suppose I were to project the thought to someone against the etheric body, I would never do it because that's a form of black magic. It's like a hypnotic suggestion. If that person did not know themselves and they couldn't hear the difference between their thought and my thought, they could act just as though they had been under hypnosis and given a hypnotic suggestion. It's important to cultivate an inner life. It doesn't have to be all deep, hard prayer and things like that, but we have to get to know ourselves. You know, we can't be out there laughing and joking and playing with other people when we could be with our, I'm not saying that we should become antisocial, but it's clear to me that I spent way too much of my life in trivial activity that didn't have anything to do with spiritual growth. But in any case, in the normal course of activity that we're talking about, the thought gets projected against the desire body. And the thought projected against the desire body, if it is sufficiently strong and it gets to the feeling of interest, that activates one of the twin forces of repulsion or attraction. Now, a lot of the time, we have mixed motivations. And a thought will come in, and all of the energy will be dissipated because one desire is fighting against another desire. And we can't carry it out. And if we can't carry out our thoughts because of an internal struggle in ourselves, we become neurotic. It's healthy to take our impulses and take them all the way from the spirit to carry them out in the material world. Some of them only go as far as thoughts, some of them only go as far as desires, but that's by intent. If we're in the automobile, we can't be hesitant, and we can't be fighting, well, am I, we can't be fighting like saying in ourselves, am I too much of a wimp about this, or do I need to get out there and battle? But that's, you know, we have all kinds of struggles where we have mixed motivations, and we can exhaust it. Now, those thoughts that have become desire impulses that never make it out of the desire world, they're still there. They're stored. So eventually they're taken back into the spirit. And, you know, it's one of those things when you look, it's like when you look back at your life and say, oh my goodness, what did I do there? What did I waste there in indecision or in this kind of purposeless, empty, you know, battle of desires within myself? Now, the thought that is now clothed in desire, that's the word the Rosicrucian Cosmo Conception used, is clothed. I don't use that. I'm a nude thinker. I often make all my notes while I'm sitting nude. But I've even gotten away from that some now. It doesn't make any difference whether I have clothes on or off. I used to... It's a total side trip, but I read Benjamin Franklin's autobiography, and Benjamin Franklin said that he found it was a psychologically healthy thing to do his writing in the nude because then he felt completely free and unencumbered, and he didn't have external inhibitions that awakened internal inhibitions. And I thought that's great, and I followed that for many years, but now it doesn't make any difference. Clothes on, doesn't make clothes off, no difference. What happens when that thought clothed in desire gets projected into the positive pole of the reflecting ether? In many cases, it is the positive pole of the reflecting ether is like a sausage machine or something like that. It takes one thought and all the possibilities of them, it ramifies. It's not always the case when there's an emergency, like am I going to rear-end this guy or not, but very often that thought gets ramified in the ethers. And you could say that it is completing of thinking, because then everything doesn't have to be deliberated in the mind. That's a good way of looking at it, but I don't think you should call what happens in the reflecting ether thoughts, I think you should call them in the modern parlance something like thoughtoids. And those thoughtoids are created and they're carried out. It's almost like you throw a stone in the water and the ripples go in all the directions. And when you have a thought, those thoughts are carried many, many directions. Some of them make it to the consciousness through the etheric brain and into our waking consciousness. Not all of them. Some of them do. But they're still there. I've had the experience. Other people have had the experience. You can all have the experience of being in the reflecting ether and picking them out. I've had occasions where I've been thinking on a subject and it's exciting. And then for some reason or another, I lay down and take a nap. Probably laziness, because I'm lazy and I like to take a lot of naps. And you take a nap when you're wide awake, when you really don't need to take a nap. So your sleep is very shallow. It doesn't take you deep. And sometimes when that happens, you find yourself in the reflecting ether and you see the thing you were just thinking about. There were many other conclusions, many other thoughtoids that were produced, and they all follow their chains like, it's something like reason chains, and it's a marvelous kind of thing. People who do things with writing music tell me that in such a state they can see that there are all kinds of variables, you know, that are melodies that are close to the melody that they eventually settled on that are carried out in the reflecting ether. Some of these we retrieve too. We retrieve all kinds of things. Sometimes, like if you're a probationary student, you know, like in the Rosicrucian Fellowship, there are several steps to becoming an initiate. And the first step is a studentship. And the next step, you're put on probation, just like a prisoner is put on probation. You know, are you clean enough to be let into the temple? And then you get discipleship, which is when you are actually received direct teaching from a spiritual teacher. And when you're in that probationer state, because you have taken a vow to serve, you take the vow to yourself, of course. You've taken that vow to serve. What happens is you are given communications from teachers. And the teacher for the probationers of the Rosicrucian Fellowship, from time to time, transmits lessons to all of the probationers. But most of the time, you don't get them consciously. They're just like the factoids that never made it to the waking surface of your consciousness when you're in your body. But sometimes when you're in one of those states, half in and half out, or if you're retrospecting, and suddenly you start retrospecting, and you see pictures that are moving all over the place, and they're like symbolic diagrams, and those are what have been sent to you by the teacher. There are a lot of probationers that are going to be tremendously surprised when they leave their body, and they start going through the past life panorama. They're going to see all sorts of things they never knew were there in the first place. This is, you know, it's important to be able to get your sensitivity in a place where you can pick these kinds of things up. All right, where are we? All right. When the thought is pertinent to the activity, like the activity of the automobile, it propels motion in the physical body. It does that through the reflecting ether in what we call the nervous fluid, and that controls the muscles. And we pull our foot back off of the accelerator, and we slow down because we realize it would be a foolhardy thing to try to pass at this point because it's just too iffy or too dangerous. Now, this is something every one of us does probably every day. All day when we're walking down the street, we're not as deliberating as when we were little children learning to walk. You can see the little child is trying really hard to walk. It's trying to keep its center of balance. We don't do that when we walk, but that's involved in our consciousness. We are capable of being self-conscious of that, provided it doesn't distract us from the important things that we're doing. But this is a cycle that goes on all the time. And this is why this cycle is elaborated in such detail in the Rosicrucian Cosmo concept, because it is a cycle that we experience, that we can improve on, and that we can make our life better, and we can drive down the highway of life so that everybody reaches where they're trying to get, safe, sound, and in an easy way. Now, there's something more in all of this. I said something earlier that is like a psychoanalyst says, and that is that it is healthy that we carry our judgments all the way through as far as we need to carry them. If we don't, if we pull back, or if we have feeble thoughts, it changes our psychology. We become neurotic. Sigmund Freud said that coitus interruptus results in neurosis. That's because he saw things strictly in sexual terms. Anything that isn't carried out to its end produces neurosis. For psychological health, follow-through is all important. The follow-through after you've hit the ball, whether it's a baseball or a golf ball, the part of the swing afterward is just as important as the part beforehand. It's part of an arc. And what we're talking about here is an arc of consciousness. We're talking about the way we live in a continuous cycle that we go through perhaps thousands or hundreds of thousands of times a day. Now, while we're talking about psychological health, let's briefly talk about something else that is huge. We could talk every day for the remainder of this year about it. We're talking about this cycle that we repeat millions of times in life over many lives. And when we do that, we put emphasis on things. And some things we excel at, and some things we don't do so well at. And in our egoistic ways, which may or may not be right, we like to do the things that we do well, and we try to stay away from the things that we don't do well. So we like the activities we like, we give our attention to, we give our time to, we give our whole life to them. So if we're doing this for an exceedingly long time, we develop strong likes and dislikes. And sometimes human, you know, the whole cycle has a sense of proportion to it. How fast we come to a judgment depends on the situation. But there is a tempo to the whole cycle. And we should be fluent in all parts of the cycle. If we get imbalanced, that's the other factor in psychological health, lack of follow-through and balance, any one of those things produces difficult psychological or mental conditions. And so after doing this many times for many lives, we may get stuck. We may like the objects outside of us and may be afraid of the spirit inside of us. Or we may like the spiritual recognition and avoid the objects. The former person is called an extrovert. The latter is called an introvert. And that is extrovert and introvert relative to the object. The psychologists only do things relative to the object because they are, for the most part, materialists. A mystic would do things relative to the spirit, to the subject, because that is the spiritual responsibility. That's what is in charge of the subject-object relationship. Now, some people like the introversive activity better. I have a friend that'll do something for a couple hours and then spend the next 10 hours processing it. Some people like the creative process of going from within out. And so one is introversive and one is extroversive, which is different than being an introvert or an extrovert. Some people get stuck in the stuff. They like the textures of things. Other people get stuck in the actions, in the etheric activity. Other people get stuck in the desires. Unfortunately, that's often me. Other people get stuck in the thought. And some people don't want to leave that realm of intuition. But health in all of this means carrying out the entire cycle. And it's important that we study ourselves. It doesn't have to be according to any psychology of this defines an introvert or an extrovert or do a Myers-Briggs or something like that. Astrology and spiritual philosophy is much more extensive and it's much more accurate than any of those tests, and it's very helpful. You know, this is again getting to know ourselves. Right now, because we have valued so much taking the creative force that is behind all of the thoughts, desires, and actions, we've taken that into our hands. All of humanity is outward and downward into the world of senses. All of humanity is stuck. We're stuck in materialism from our having abused the basic creative force. It is now our part to keep the cycle clear and clean and balanced from one end to the other, because all of us are probably biased. it's very rare that someone comes along that is completely clean and that doesn't have a hitch or that isn't sluggish in some part of the cycle. So all psychological health depends on follow-through and balance. Perhaps sometime we can go into psychology, both astrologically and spiritually, looking into the kinds of insanity that happens when people get stuck. We can't have favorites. We can't have preferences to the detriment of the entire experience. All right, we have...
The
introvert has an inner preference and the extrovert has an outer preference. And somebody who is introversive likes turning, the act of turning inward rather than the act of turning outward. You can get quite sophisticated with it. In fact, it can become a huge, enormous system. Using mysticism, it's far more even than Carl Jung. Carl Jung has a book called The Psychology of Types. That is a very excellent place to begin, and he shows just how it applies to literature and everything else. But what's most important to us is how it applies to our lives and what we do with our lives. That is as far as we're going to go tonight, and tomorrow we'll try to take something a little bit heavier. And for now, we'll close with the Rosicrucian prayer. O God, increase our love for Thee so that we may serve Thee better from day to day. Let the words of our mouths and the meditation of our hearts be acceptable in Thy sight, O Lord, our strength and our Redeemer.